But the bulk of the conscientious objectors, the younger men, were expected to do some alternative service. And that alternative service was decided not by the men, but by the government. And much of it was expected to be under military control. And the result was that, to put it bluntly, nearly all my contemporaries in England among friends went to prison rather than accept the alternative service. And another byproduct of that was that a considerable renewed interest in prison reform after the war was over resulted. These boys had learned what prisons were like for the first time. In fact, there were quite many boys put in prison in this country, also in the First and Second World War. Some years ago, the head of the federal prison, James Bennett, was talking to a leading friend. He said, "We very much miss the Quakers in prison. We wish there were some where they were a good influence in prison. We wish there were some legal way in which we could get a lot of them back into prison." He didn't find any legal way in peacetime, but this indicates why the friends became acquainted with prison conditions. And the earlier interest in prison conditions, and now in 1916-20, and again in 1940-45, friends got some first-hand information about prisons. That was all an unexpected, as I call it, velvet from this experience. In the two world wars, the laws weren't quite identical in America. And in England, they were not quite identical either. But there were a substantial number of friends and others who took the conscientious position and met varying circumstances. For instance, I've already said that a lot of the men had already been volunteering their services in France in ambulance work under civilian officers. When the law came and suggested as an alternative to military service, civilian military work as ambulance people, stretcher carriers, and so on, a lot of these men came home to face the law. And one of my friends was serving his sentence in prison, and the general principle in England in the First World War was 6 months sentence and then rearrested, and then put them in again, and so on, so that some of them served a 7 or 8 6 months term of this sort. The name for this is the cat and mouse method of treatment. One of my friends was serving one of his sentences when he was decorated by the government in prison for bravery near the lines as a stretcher carrier under the Friends Ambulance Unit. Something rather odd about that. He was now a criminal, you see, serving a sentence in prison, but he was decorated for bravery a few months earlier, before the law was passed. In America, this problem was put on the lap of President Wilson, And he had too much to attend to do very much about it. It was a minor problem. And therefore, there was a good deal of uncertainty. The law said that a man whose religious training and belief made him conscientiously opposed to war could be exempted from military service for such occupation as the president decided upon. And the president never decided. These boys had to carry on with that uncertainty. But the friends organized a relief unit to go to France. The draft boards, which had the ultimate decision of what to do with these men, mostly decided that if men had volunteered for Quaker relief abroad in France and or Russia among civilians, was doing adequate alternative service. And furloughed them from the army for this kind of service. Also, men that were brought up on the farms could get furloughed to do farm work in this country, because that was very essential too. But these were simply some of the forms in which this problem expressed itself in the First World War. In the Second World War in America, the government, thinking it could do something even better, set up a series of camps, or authorized the setting up of a series of civilian camps for to provide occupation for the men who took this position. It was called civilian public service. The camps were partly under the civilian branches of the government, like the Department of Health, or the Department of Agriculture, Department of Interior, and these camps were intended to provide collectively places where men who took this point of view could engage in productive work, but not directly under the military. Of course, they have to go before the draft boards and be have this accepted. And those that took the position that was called absolutist decided that they would do this, except that in doing it, they were doing an alternative to military service, and were relieving the government, and were, in a sense, making a concession in their strict understanding of a protest against war. These camps were an interesting experiment. Talking to a man yesterday who was writing a thesis on the history of CPS, and it didn't prove entirely satisfactory from the Quaker point of view, and I don't know that it did from the government point of view. For one thing, the rules in these camps were under civilian control. The Friends had some, the Mennonites had some, the Church of the Brethren had some. Members of those churches were the conductors of the camp in charge. There were also military rules in the background, and they were under double control, partly civilian, but triple control, partly religious civilian groups running and raising the money for them, by the way, not paid for by the government. Partly the Department of the Interior or the Department of Agriculture or something like that, directing the projects which they were engaged to. Most of the projects were rural projects. Firefighting in Oregon, agricultural experimenting in Ohio, care of the national parks in various places, provision of fire water holes against forest fires in other parts of the country, quite a variety of projects. But these, you see, would be done under the department. A representative of the Department of Agriculture would be there, the friend who was in charge, or the Mennonite, older person, would be there. And then behind it all were, of course, the restrictions that the military, selective service, we call that, insisted upon. A noble gesture, and but one that didn't work out with really great success, certainly from the point of view of the men who were in the camps. Of course, at times a lot of the men left the camps and went to prison rather than to stay. The moment you left the camp, of course, you were a deserter and were treated as violating the law, and they just took their medicine. Well, that is a complicated experience. I can't try to explain it all. Some of us have pretty vivid memories of there are some interesting things about it. I remember going to one camp. I traveled around and visited the camps a little bit. There were 16 PhDs in one camp up in New York State. And the American Legion in the next town, of course, made it very unpleasant for them. They didn't want the camp there. They tried to get it moved away. They regarded these people as traitors. subversive and so on. So that we had some interesting problems of that sort. Since the Second World War, we've had peacetime conscription, and it's just been renewed for another term of years. It also has provision for conscientious objection, in which the draft board, to which they personally belong, which makes the decision, can allow them to do something else as alternative service. Very often in public institutions, like hospitals or insane asylums or correctional institutions and various other kinds. During the Second World War, a rider was passed on one of the other laws of Congress for preventing any conscientious objectors from leaving the country. So that meant that we couldn't do what we did in the First World War, really useful work near the field of combat for the poor people there, yes.
During peacetime, do Quakers have an objection to alternative service? Do the absolutists have an objection to alternative service?
Yes, I think some of them do, and some of them will accept it. In both wartime and peacetime, those that took the absolutist position were less than those that took the government opportunity. Now, I don't think they were happy with it. I think their conscience was bothering them all the time. And in order to get an easy conscience, the easiest thing to do is take the absolutist position. But I know now a good many young men. Of course, now in peacetime, the proportion of men that are conscripted, as you know, for various reasons, is very much smaller. There are all kinds of exemptions, so for other reasons, health and education or something else, so that the chance of being involved is less. The total number is less. But of those who are caught by the conscription law, a good many that I know are doing alternative service. And it all depends on the draft board whether they accept that. Some draft boards will accept a man that's working in a peace organization as doing a public service, and he's furloughed to work as an assistant or an apprentice in a Quaker peace organization. That's going rather far, but it shows how generous the draft board can be. In England, in the Second World War, the situation was somewhat better than in the First. In the First World War, a number of conscientious objectors were, in spite of their position, were shipped to France, and there, of course, they became under military control, where the rules were much stricter and they were court-martialed. And only the last-minute appeal from members of Parliament succeeded in freeing these boys from being shot as disobedient in the British forces. In the Second World War, they didn't come nearly that close to that difficulty. And they were allowed various alternatives then. Other countries, if that interests you, have mostly by now accepted the principle of legitimacy of a person on religious grounds taking the conscientious objector position. The Scandinavian countries, all of them do it, and the conscientious objector there is mostly given the alternative of doing forestry work under government control, but entirely civilian work there. There are laws of this sort even in Iron Curtain countries. Though the Iron Curtain authorities like to tell us that, of course, we don't have any, that every conscientious man approves of our policy, Cold War policy, and that they don't have any. In Germany, during the Second World War, there were conscientious objectors, and though there was no general law covering them, I know individual friends in Germany, very few of them really suffered much. One was a doctor, and I knew, and they just kept deferring him. Another was a younger man, and they just never called him up. He was acquainted with the officer of his company to which he would have belonged, and he simply stayed at home and did what he would have done in peacetime. These were ways in which and the small quantity involved in those countries these things are overlooked. In Austria, in the First World War, the conscientious objectors were sent to insane asylums. Their position was regarded as sufficient to commit them to mental institutions. I mean as patients in this case. In America, a good many of them ultimately, in the Second World War, worked as orderlies in insane asylums. And another byproduct of that, like what I said about prisons in England, was that after the war was over, there were hundreds of conscientious objectors who had lived in our institutions, the mental institutions, and knew the worst of them. I once made a remark that of my children, all but one, 3 out of 4, were in mental institutions, which was true. The one that was Bryn Mawr didn't like that. but it was not in such an institution. And they learned quite a lot about conditions there. They were very poor during the war, the conditions were pretty bad, and therefore they were ready, after the war was over, to organize a national organization on mental health. The National Health, Mental Health Organization was largely founded by former CEOs in the Second World War. Towards the end of the war, the government not only allowed them to get out of these camps, some of them, limited number of them, and to work in institutions of this sort, but also furloughed them for medical experiments. They were allowed to become guinea pigs in medical experiments, did so in well-controlled medical conditions. I knew a group, including a recent Harvard graduate of that time, who were in a starvation experiment at the University of Minnesota. They lived on the university campus. They were carefully measured. Everything they ate was very carefully measured. Their diet was gradually taken down, so they were hungrier and hungrier and hungrier. But carefully watched. They had the honor system by which no boy could go downtown alone. Another boy went with him, so that the terrific temptation of stopping in and eating something would be avoided. And they were brought down in weight in this way, in order that after they'd gotten down thin enough and weak enough, they could be experimented with to see what you do with starving people and what is the best way, slowly, to bring them back to normal diet. This was in preparation for the situations was anticipated after the Second World War, because after the First World War, we had to deal with whole nations of starving people in Europe, and it would be helpful. And these boys did this with a good deal of personal difficulty. It took a lot of courage. One or two in the unit broke down and broke the rules, spoiled the test as far as they were concerned, but it was carried through in order that they might know what was the wisest way after the war to bring these people back to total nourishment. And others had experiments, you know what they do in an experiment, they take 20 boys, 10 of them are exposed to a disease and 10 of them are not, and then they experiment on them medically, various ways. These were rather interesting things that they did. I've never heard a report. I've heard a report of some of these experiments as having contributed to medical information. And I think the boys that were in that were better satisfied to be doing that sort of thing than to be manicuring the parks in Tennessee, for instance. Not a very attractive form of national service in the emergency for most of them. Thank you.